From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The toll on wildlife from the ongoing oil spill in the Gulf is growing. So far, nearly 50 sea mammals appear to have been killed, over 350 sea turtles, and nearly 900 birds. Watching the birds and trying to figure out how best to help the ones that can be helped is Melanie Driscoll. She's Louisiana Director of Bird Conservation for the National Audubon Society. I spoke with her last month along the Gulf. This week, she's been out in Louisiana's Barataria Bay, and she described seeing three pelicans on a beach.
They looked quite heavily oiled. They were holding their wings out as if to dry them, but obviously the oil wouldn't dry. They were also preening pretty obsessively. They were taking their bills and rubbing the bills down the feathers, potentially ingesting the oil, trying to clean those feathers so that they could go out and hunt and look for fish and thermoregulate. The state took a small boat called a pirogue. It's a little Louisiana boat. And as he got within a somewhat reasonable distance, the birds flew away. It took them a bit to get up off the ground. It was fairly labored flight, but they were able to fly away. And they went into the middle of the colony, so any attempt to capture those birds would cause tremendous disturbance.
And that raises a real question, right, of how far do you go if you're trying to rescue oiled birds? At what point do you create more of a danger for the ones that may not be oiled yet?
Well, that's one of the big concerns. So what I had thought I might see was, 40 or 50% of the birds on the island covered in oil. And it's nowhere near that yet. Most of the birds on these islands look really pretty clean and pretty good. But there are oiled individuals throughout. There are some adults with oiling. There are royal terns with some oil on them. But they're surrounded by birds that are clean. So if you approach, say, a nest with an oiled pelican chick in it, and you approach, even if you can grab that chick out of the nest, say with a net, it may have a sibling that's not oiled. And if that sibling jumps out and goes through the roots of the mangroves or through the marsh grass or onto rocks, then that chick is oiled. Well, the nests are so close together, you don't disturb just one nest, you may disturb 20. So at what point have you caused more harm than good?
And interesting, too, that these birds that you describe as pretty heavily oiled were still able to fly, were able to elude capture.
Right. They're powerful birds. They have strong wings. At some point, those birds will be oiled enough or sick enough to capture. There's a strong criticism that people are waiting until birds are so sick that they might not survive the washing process. But again, you can kill them during the capture if they're too mobile. So it's a real dilemma. Nobody wants to have to make these decisions. Nobody's happy about having to sit and leave oiled birds on an island.
Melanie, I'm looking at a photograph you took of a huge pile of badly oiled boom that's on the water right near nesting brown pelicans. This is boom that had not been picked up by the cleanup crews down there. What's going on?
Well, that's been one of the greatest frustrations that I think could be fairly easily remedied. That boom got oiled a couple weeks before I was there and was literally piled up within nests on the islands. When the cleanup crews got out there to pull the boom out, they were supervised by biologists, and they were able to pull the boom out without really disturbing the nesting birds at all. And it only took about an hour. Why that wasn't done before at one of the highest priority nesting sites in Louisiana, that I can't figure out. That's a severe frustration. We can't clean the oil off with birds there, not without creating a lot of harm. But at the very least, you could pull out the oiled boom and put in new absorbent boom. And that should be being done a lot faster, in my opinion.
Melanie Driscoll is Louisiana Director of Bird Conservation for the National Audubon Society. Melanie, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Adam Ross's first novel, Mr. Peanut, begins with this provocative line. When David Pepin first dreamed of killing his wife, he didn't kill her himself. He dreamed convenient acts of God. It's a very dark tale of love, hate, murder, and marriage. It's clever. It's structurally complex with characters whose lives interlock. Adam Ross joins us from Nashville. Crack the story's shell, he says. There's a nugget of a true story inside.
Back in 1995, my father told me a story about my cousin, which really haunted me for years. And that was my second cousin, who was morbidly obese, suffered terribly from depression and also had lethal nut allergies, apparently committed suicide. And conveniently, the only person to witness her suicide was her husband, who reported that he came home. She was sitting at the kitchen table with a plate of peanuts before her. They got into an argument. And at the height of the argument, she had ingested a peanut and died of anaphylactic shock right in front of him.
So suicide by peanut eating.
Suicide by peanut eating. But when I heard the story, I was thunderstruck by it because it seemed to me like an obvious case of murder. And so I sat down and drafted what essentially were the first three chapters of the novel now. I mean, of course, with some changes. But what was utterly mysterious to me about that story is that it seemed to put its finger right on something that is so true about marriage, which is that at times it is harder to understand what keeps couples together as opposed to what drives them apart. It's a moment of terrible privacy. And I wanted to explore different moments of those kinds of privacy in the novel.
You frequently allude to M.C. Escher, who's the artist who has those mathematically themed black and white prints where in one you are drawn to a staircase that could be either leading up or down. You play with this idea about shifting between a thing and its opposite. Why is that a theme? What was so important about that?
Well, you know, I like to say Mr. Peanut is the story of three marriages that tell the story of one marriage, or one marriage that tells the story of three. It's about a guy, David Pepin, who may or may not have killed his wife, Alice, very much in the same way that I described from the autobiographical story. So as you learn about David's marriage, you also learn about the marriages of the two detectives who are investigating him, Ward Hastrell and Sam Shepard. Well, what you find as you read the novel is that the marriages share certain similarities. They share certain moments of redemption, certain moments of, you know, crazy Mexican standoffs. And so they interlock, like many of M.C. Escher's designs. But more importantly, they point to, I think, how there can be sudden shifts in marriage where you can go from just love and contentment with somebody to its opposite almost immediately. In the same way you can look at an Escher and you're looking at a staircase going up that suddenly becomes a staircase going down with somebody sitting on the ceiling.
I want to get you to read a passage. And here, a hitman is reflecting on the husbands who have hired him to kill their wives. And it begins with, "You know, Dr. Sam."
Sure. "You know, Dr. Sam," Mobius said, "there's this funny thing that happens to some men before I kill their wives. Kind of a buyer's remorse. I guess because occasionally after the money's changed hands and I've got my Marks brake set to fail, her patio rigged to collapse, or the furnace ready to blow CO2, every so often the husband will phone me in a panic the night before to call the whole thing off. He'll be apologetic, a little embarrassed. He claims he doesn't care about the lost deposit. Just abort, he says. And I'll agree, it's a substantial sum of money. But when I ask why he doesn't want to go through with it, he says the same thing every time. Things, he says, are getting better. Things, he says, have improved. There's real optimism in his voice, practically newlywed glee. Sometimes he'll even say, 'Thank you, Mr. Mobius. If it weren't for you, I don't think my wife and I would have gotten to this point in our relationship. We're happier now than ever. I owe you more than you know.' We hang up, and I smile a little smile to myself, because a week or two later, the same guy calls back and says the same thing." What's that? "Kill the bitch."
I come away not sure what to think, to be quite honest with you. It's a very confounding book.
Well, when you say confounding, tell me what you mean exactly.
That it's hard to move away from the theme of men killing their wives. I see your point that there are moments of great love between all of these characters, but the violence is always there. And it makes me think that this is some way, some revelation about men that maybe I didn't understand.
Gosh. You know, I think that when I set out to write this book, I wanted to go back to that moment that I described with my cousin and really ask this question: how is it that people who start out so happily get to this very dark place where things can go so awry. And really, it's funny, I would actually argue that the novel is about as pro-marriage a book as I could ever imagine writing, because it's a cautionary tale. You need to do good housekeeping. You have to be present to each other. And in the moment, when it comes to all the ins and outs of living together that confront you, because you'll go through periods in marriage's cycling where you'll lose sight of each other. And if you lose sight of each other for too long, then you can be lost to that person and they can be lost to you before you're even aware of it. And that's a very tragic thing. And so, you know, in a way, Mr. Peanut for me is an attempt to wake up readers to what's right in front of them.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Adam Ross's first novel is Mr. Peanut. Ross tells us he's been married for a long time, and happily so. To hear more of our conversation and another reading, go to npr.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And here on the radio, you can follow NPR's Deb Amos. Deb, I believe you're on your way back over to the Middle East in the coming weeks.
Yes,
we'll be listening.
Great 2 weeks.
All right. Glad you could come in, fill in for Renee. Why don't you do the show close one more time?
This is NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's go from Operation Stolen Dreams to what you might call Operation Potato Chip. One of the bizarre footnotes to the investigation involves what turned up in a can of Pringles. Yeah, that's the Pringles jingle. It comes up in this investigation because of a man named Garrett Gilliland. He was an unlicensed mortgage broker suspected of a role in a $100 million mortgage fraud. Prosecutors have been watching him, and that may be why they became suspicious when another man sent him a Pringles potato chip can. Authorities say they intercepted it, and what they found inside was less crunchy than you might expect. Instead of potato chips, they found $20,000 in cash, which is our last word in business today. A federal grand jury has indicted the sender for what is called bulk cash smuggling.
Business News is produced by Jessica Smith, and Morning Edition is edited by Greg Myrie and Martha Wexler.
Our editorial staff includes Rena Advani, Janita Anderson, Anne Hawk, Kitty Isley, Jordana Hochman, Laura Krantz, and Maeve McGoran, with Shannon Rhodes and Sasha Woodruff at NPR West.
Morning Edition's executive producer is Madalika Sika. The director of morning programming is Ellen McDonald.
Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Welcome to Recovery Summer. At least that's what the White House is calling it. The Obama administration is pouring billions of dollars into summer construction projects, hoping to get Americans back to work. To highlight the effort, President Obama joined a group of hard-hat construction workers in Ohio today. He was there to break ground on a road improvement project funded by economic stimulus money. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The groundbreaking near Nationwide Children's Hospital in downtown Columbus marks the beginning of the 10,000th road improvement project funded by the stimulus. President Obama says pouring all that concrete and widening all those lanes has created a lot of needed jobs, both directly and indirectly.
They've put thousands of construction crews, just like this one, to work. They've spurred countless small businesses to hire because, you know, these are some big guys here, so they got to eat. Which means that you got to get some food brought in, or the local restaurants here benefit from the crews being here at work.
But the president acknowledged many more jobs are needed, with national unemployment still at 9.7% and Ohio's jobless rate even higher. This summer, the nature of stimulus spending will shift away from preserving jobs in state and local government towards more public works. There will be six times as many highway projects as last summer, eight times as many national parks projects, and 20 times as many water projects.
Instead of worrying about where their next paycheck is going to come from, Americans across the country are helping to build our future and their own futures.
But pollster Michael Dimmock of the Pew Research Center says the administration has a political problem. Americans don't believe all that asphalt the government's paying for is putting us on the road to recovery.
The public doesn't feel we've turned the corner yet. They're still pretty gloomy about the state of the economy, and they're skeptical that the stimulus plan passed last year has really made much of a difference.
In a Pew survey this month, more people said they think the president's policies are hurting the economy than making it better. The largest group think the policies haven't made much difference. In fact, many independent economists say the stimulus has helped to revive the economy and prevent even bigger job losses. But Vice President Biden, who oversees the program, says it's totally understandable that many Americans don't see it that way.
It's real simple. The measurement is it feeling better? Am I more confident? Can I go, instead of getting my hair cut every 7 weeks, can I go back to getting it done once a month or once every 3 weeks? Can I take a vacation? Am I going to buy this car? Do I feel better I'm going to be able to make my mortgage payment?
The administration is planning a high-visibility campaign this summer to promote stimulus projects, with more televised groundbreakings and a lot of Recovery Act logos posted along freeways and in national parks. Dimmick cautions the Recovery Summer campaign could be a double-edged sword.
Seeing those signs may remind people the government is taking steps to try to help the economy and provide jobs, but it also reminds people the government's spending a lot of money, and that's not so popular right now.
Indeed, concern about government spending is so strong, the Senate was unable to muster the votes this week to extend unemployment benefits. The government doesn't have a lot of time to change people's attitudes about the economy. Recovery summer will be closely followed by midterm election autumn. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The third time is not always a charm for a movie series, but film critic Kenneth Turan says Toy Story 3 is a sequel that matches the creativity of the original.
It's been more than a decade since the last film, and the inevitable has happened. Andy, the young boy who owns all the Toy Story characters, has gotten older and is in fact heading for college. The toys, including Woody and Buzz Lightyear, are increasingly afraid of being left behind. Through a series of mistakes and misadventures, Andy's toys end up in Sunnyside, a cheery-looking daycare center where they are welcomed with open arms by the head toy, Lotso Huggin' Bear. Lotso for short.
You'll never be outgrown or neglected, never abandoned or forgotten. No owners means no heartbreak.
Despite these honeyed words, however, Sunnyside has a darker, more violent side, as Andy's toys discover all too soon.
Rex?
Toy Story 3 was directed by Lee Unkrich, who worked on both previous films, and written by Michael Arndt, an Oscar winner for Little Miss Sunshine. Because of them, this film does the impossible, making us believe that toys are people too, idiosyncratic individuals with lives and minds of their own. Toy Story 3 is also a movie about movies. It's got references to John Ford Westerns, Hayao Miyazaki animation, and the kind of prison films where someone plays the harmonica on death row. How great that this tribute to old-fashioned toys becomes a love note to old-fashioned movies as well.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the LA Times. We have reviews of a dark comedy, a darker thriller, two documentaries, and more, all opening this week. It's all at our website, npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos. The Los Angeles Lakers are NBA champions for the second year in a row. Last night in L.A., the Lakers beat their arch rivals, the Boston Celtics. It was a slugfest of a game, and fans said it seemed more like football than basketball. The 83-79 victory in Game 7 of their series gave the Lakers their 16th title in franchise history. From Los Angeles, NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Moments after the final horn, purple and gold confetti glittered its way from the rafters to the floor of Staples Center. Somewhere in the delirious crowd of 19,000, 70-year-old Buzz Merrill of Marina Del Rey undoubtedly was smiling and probably shaking his head at the turn of events, because when I approached Merrill at halftime and popped the question of the day, Game 7 of the NBA Finals, Lakers versus Celtics, doesn't get any better than that, does it, Buzz? he wasn't in the mood.
It's a special time when these guys get together, especially for a game seven.
Not particularly. Not into all this, oh, the seventh game or the this or the that. I just want them to win.
But at halftime, the Lakers only had 34 points and were behind. Once the second half started, it didn't get better.
Rajon Rondo, timeout, Lakers.
By the time Boston point guard Rajon Rondo gave his team an 11-point lead early in the third quarter, the Staples Center crowd was restless. Boston was in control, and LA's savior, Kobe Bryant, hardly was in savior mode. He was shooting the ball horribly, committing turnovers, fouling opponents. He explained later he was on E, as in empty.
The more I tried to push, the more it kept getting away from me. And I'm just glad that my teammates, you know, really got us back in the game, and it was a tough one.
In particular, teammates Lamar Odom and Ron Artest played key roles in keeping the Lakers close. LA overcame a 13-point third-quarter deficit and pulled ahead in the fourth, but Boston refused to fold. It was 81-79 Lakers when LA reserve guard Sasha Vujacic went to the free-throw line with 11.7 seconds left. Vujacic had only played 4.5 minutes all night. He swished the first one for a 3-point lead, and the second, making it 83-79, and that was it. After hearing endlessly during the series from both teams about the importance of defense, the Lakers and Celtics played an all-out defensive classic. LA won its championship shooting a woeful 32.5% from the field, but for those who like their basketball rough and intense, this was a gem. The experience left Boston's Ray Allen deeply disappointed and drained.
The air was thick. You know, it didn't get any thicker than that. You know, you had to find the best way you knew how to get stops and to just bowl your way to try and get to the basket.
Kobe Bryant tried and failed more often than not. He shot the ball 24 times and made only 6 baskets, but he sank key free throws near the end and grabbed a whopping 15 rebounds. He was named most valuable player of these hard-fought finals. Bryant had been grumpy, surly, choose your term, throughout the postseason, but last night, as expected, victory loosened his lips. In fact, it was as if Bryant drank truth serum. He admitted all that gruff stuff he told reporters, that he didn't care about Lakers versus Celtics, the NBA's greatest rivalry through the years. That was a lie.
You guys know how, what a student I am with the game. I mean, I know every series that the Lakers have played in. I mean, I was a Laker nut. And I know every Celtics series. I know every statistic. So, you know, it meant the world to me as well, but I couldn't focus on it. I had to focus on playing.
Bryant earned his 5th championship with the Lakers, and not that anyone's counting his titles, but it appears he is, particularly in comparison to his one-time teammate, center Shaquille O'Neal.
He's got one more than Shaq. So you can take that to the bank.
The Lakers, with their 16th title, now are just one shy of the NBA record, held by the Boston Celtics. Last night, LA got some payback after losing to Boston in the 2008 finals. Indeed, despite what the record book says, the Lakers hardly are feeling second best to anyone. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Los Angeles. Okay.